All right, the committee will come to order, and the first bill up on the agenda is House File 587, Representative Murphy, and we are going to be hearing this bill today, but not taking action on the bill, as I understand it. So, welcome to the... I guess we probably don't even have to put it before us then. Okay, except that you're before us, so welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and it's nice to be before the committee. And I am here today, and I'm not going to do much talking because we have with me Donna Dunn and Bob Tracy and members of MNCASA and others here today to talk about sexual violence prevention, which is House File 587, which we're not going to move today and not going to be taking a vote. I think this is an issue we've talked about before. I think this is a piece of legislation that we need to act upon. But I don't know that we have the revenue to do it, and we're all being smart about that this year in this committee, trying to be, so I'm trying to be respectful of that. When I agreed to carry this bill, and we introduced it last session, I thought I had a pretty good understanding of what it meant to prevent sexual violence, and as I have begun to dig into the issue and work with the advocates, I am learning a lot about the issue, about the tentacles into our communities and into our families. And while I think there are important things that we need to do as policymakers to address this issue, there are also important things that we're going to need to do in our clinics and in our schools and in our communities. We had a meeting over, a hearing, if you will, over at the Kelly Inn a few weeks ago, and there are a number of members from this committee that were there. There was a presentation by a woman named Cordelia Anderson, and it was pretty eye-opening. And I think for those of us that were there, Democrats and Republicans, we walked away thinking we have a lot to learn and a lot to explore. Today is that first day. So I would like to turn my time over to Ms. Dunn, let her talk with you and do some presentation, and take questions when you're ready. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Thiessen and members of the committee, Representative Murphy. We appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you and to share some information during this informational hearing about the status of sexual violence in Minnesota. But really the goal of the presentation today will be for us to start the conversation about the need to address the prevention of violence that uses sex as a priority in Minnesota. And we have historically spent our time in the criminal justice realm and with the public safety committees here at the Capitol, but we now are very committed to and focused on bringing this to you as a public health issue. That is really where we need to be going with this issue. Our presentation for today, we will be focusing on helping you understand a little bit more about violence that uses sex as a tool. We will spend some time explaining the report, The Cost of Sexual Violence in Minnesota, and then be providing some options for action. How can we prevent this? And we'll look at options that include actions both for the personal, the family, the community, and the governmental level. And then finally introduce and talk a little bit more about the framework to initiate state funding for sexual violence prevention that Representative Murphy has talked about. So, what are we talking about when we talk about violence that uses sex? We would like to share with you, as part of our testimony, a film clip from a DVD which we co-produced with Twin Cities Public Television about sexual violence. And this will help you get a broader view of the kinds of experiences that Minnesotans have had with sexual violence.
Sexual violence in this country is like loading up a 747 with women and crashing it into the ocean every single day. Every single day we load up a 747 with women, we crash it into the ocean day after day after day.
Stop Sexual Violence, Listen and Lead is a co-production of Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault and TPT's Minnesota Channel. Major funding for this program has been provided by the Minnesota Department of Health through a grant from the Violence Against Women Act as administered by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
We need to stop sexual violence, and it's going to take every one of us on a personal, individual level, community level, networking across lines into policy legislation. We need everybody.
There's things out there that I'm learning that, you know, that a year ago I had no clue about, you know, where do we get to really, what makes good policy to help them make a difference. And that's a part of my learning piece here, is to rely on people that have been doing this for a long time and do what I can to help you support them.
So much energy in our world is consumed by people who are things that they shouldn't have to have experienced. We know that this is of epidemic proportions in Minnesota and elsewhere. We're not unusual here in Minnesota. We've done this work really on the shoulders of survivors who were willing to speak out, and those stories are still critical today.
I was living in Minneapolis with my husband. I was about to turn 30. My husband had gone off for a week to take a workshop, so I was alone in our apartment. Went to sleep behind multiple locked doors, and I woke up at 4 in the morning somewhere, like 4 in the morning, to someone in the doorway of the bedroom, and he flew through the air and landed on top of me. He had a knife. We had a struggle. I got cut up. And right on the heels of that was a voice that said, start talking. If he's here to kill you, you need to let him know who he's going to be killing. Start telling him who you are. So I started talking. It was a strange thing, but I did, and I do believe that that shifted the equation. He stayed for several hours, but I survived it.
So I was first forced to have sex at the age of 13. I was locked in a room, and I couldn't come out until it was done. And then again it happened at the age of 15, but then it was by a pimp and three other guys. I was kidnapped, I was tortured, cigarettes were put out on me, I was stabbed in the side, and made to have sex with everybody in every way you could think of. Prostitution is sexual violence. No matter how you look at it, it is sexual violence. When I look at, once I got married, and my husband coming home and sexually assaulting me, if I had to compare all three of those together, they were all the same.
As they first hear it, my experience, as I've talked to people about it, my experience is people put up incredible walls. I became aware of being sexually abused when I read an article out of Sports Illustrated in 1999. Never would have thought that I would have heard about sexual violence out of Sports Illustrated. But that helped me to come to the understanding that I was sexually abused and how it affected me. In 2002, I got to speak in front of the Bishop's Conference and share part of my story to the bishops. Since then, I've seen all kinds of different reactions. I don't know if fearful is the right word. Denial is maybe another word that they want to use. It couldn't happen in our neighborhood or to our children.
On kind of a weird date, on September 11th of 1999, I was sexually assaulted at a fraternity party. It was definitely alcohol facilitated, but there was question that I had also been slipped a date rape drug. I woke up someone that I did not know but was familiar with on top of me, and didn't know what had happened, how I'd gotten to that point. I always thought of rape as like, yeah, you were held down, you were beat up, something like that. I didn't think of it as me saying, you know, no, I need to go find my roommate. No, you just need to let me finish.
When we think about the non-stranger assault, the sense of trauma and the sense of violation is clearly the same as the person who is the victim of a stranger rape. This is a huge challenge for people to understand sexual violence. Typically, we talk about sexual violence being that really broad continuum. One of the phrases that we've used a lot is that sexual assault and rape is not about sex, it's about violence. But it bears very little resemblance, almost no resemblance, to consensual sexual activity for the survivor.
I was talking with my roommate about what happened. She knew something wasn't right. When she said to me, you know, so you kept saying no. I said, yeah, I kept telling him I had to find you. I just kept telling him I had to find you. And she said,
You were raped.
Well, those are a few of the stories about sexual violence that we have heard from people that we have worked with, and there are many, many more where that has come, where those have come from. But right now, we'd like to focus a little bit on a tool that we have available to us in Minnesota to help us understand the breadth and the depth of this issue for us, and it is the cost of Minnesota, the cost of sexual violence in Minnesota, a report that was produced by the Minnesota Department of Health. There are some points that I would like to bring to your attention, and the first is that according to this report, there were probably 61,000 Minnesotans. That's enough to almost fill that stretch to the Metrodome. 61,000 Minnesotans were most likely the victims or were victims of sexual violence in 2005. And those 61,000 probably experienced 77,000 assaults. That data is in your cost report, which you have a copy of. Another key point that we'd like to point out is that this report says that it probably the dollar impact of this issue in 1 year in Minnesota is $8 billion. We're talking about a huge cost. And then another key point is that some of these costs are direct costs to the state. And on this slide, we see what those costs are. $130.5 million regarding the criminal justice response and treatment for perpetrators. $90.5 million would be victim medical care and support. And zero state dollars targeted to primary prevention of sexual violence. Well, the cost of sexual violence report, as I said, you have a copy of that in front of you, was produced by the Minnesota Department of Health. It was published in July of 2000, includes data from the year, July of 2007, includes data from the year 2005, and is a study that was completed by the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation. It provided us some great information to help further this conversation about sexual violence and prevention. According to the report, 25% of that number in any 1 year would reflect young people who were victims of violence using sex. So we're talking about 25% of the victims in any year being under the age of 18. And of that number, fully 80% of them are girls. Of course, the remaining 75% were adults, and of that number, 72% would be women who had experienced violence using sex. Well, this gives us an opportunity to look at the scope of this issue in our society. The report does indicate that the numbers are not all inclusive. It does indicate they weren't able to analyze based on race or sexual orientation. There are some pieces of information that they were not able to collect to further fill out the aspects of the report that we would all like to know more about. On pages 6 to 7 in your report, you will see more about the specific cost of sexual violence. The $8 billion annual figure is really a fraction of the true cost. We know that there are costs that were missed in the collection of the data. We know that half of the costs that are reflected refer to responding to child victims of sexual violence. While they are not fully half of the victims, they in fact, the cost that is related to child victims of sexual violence is in fact a very large cost. This number reflects and can be compared to about $1,540 for every man, woman, and child in the state of Minnesota. And it's 3.3 times as much as the cost of alcohol-impaired driving to the state of Minnesota. So what does the government spending look like? There was a total of $221 million of government spending on sexual violence during this particular year. 59% of that was targeted to perpetrator costs, inpatient treatment, confinement. 41% of that amount was for people who were sexually assaulted. And a large part of that, about $82 million, is the cost of Medicaid related to sexual assault. These figures for the 41% for people sexually assaulted includes the amount of money that we have targeted in Minnesota to support services for victims of sexual violence. That number is fully $1 million short of what we need. We have several counties. We have 13 counties and many Indian reservations that have no services available at all. The prevention money that we are working with in the state of Minnesota comes from the CDC. It is a grant that the Minnesota Department of Health has to help us look out and institute some strategies, but we have no state funding at this point. The cost of sexual violence report does conclude with some policy implications, but they are, in fact, not particularly concrete. What the policy implications are and the recommendations are that we do need to prioritize preventing sexual violence before it occurs. That has to be vigorously pursued, adopted, and sustained. We have a history of studying this issue. An attorney general's report that was issued back in 1989. There have been several task forces that have come forward over the years. And we really believe it's time to start putting some more of our thoughts into action. So what should we be doing? In this section, we'd like to talk really briefly about some of the strategies that can be acted on to prevent sexual violence. Okay.
Well, this is about I got involved with sexual violence because Jacob was kidnapped, and I found that that's the number one motive behind kidnapping is for sexual purpose. I was outraged. Like, who would do that? And so when you step into the world of sexual violence response and services and whatever, you become aware of a whole group of people that are incredibly dedicated and doing things to make this problem smaller, to make our world safer, better. And one of the first people I met was Cordelia Anderson. Trauma specialist Dr. John Briere says, toxic decisions seem rational in a toxic environment. Anytime the mass media is filled with pornified images, and by that I mean that pair the violence, the exploitation, and the degradation with sex and make it seem as if that is sexy. When our gender socialization continues to be destructive, and then on top of it, we as adults are unwilling to talk about healthy sexuality in a comprehensive way and give accurate information, we have a sexually toxic society. What I'm excited about is that the field that is primarily focused in how do we help victims to survive and to heal after the trauma and after the victimization, have a chance to really focus in how do we mobilize around prevention? What do we do so that this never happens to anyone?
Certainly over 30 years we've been educating kids and we've done all of the sort of personal safety work. We've taught women self-defense. We've work to make our policies better about intervening, in terms of law enforcement and prosecutors and so forth. And that hasn't stopped it. It hasn't changed anything. We are as good at developing and growing sex offenders in our communities as we ever have been. The Minnesota Department of Health did work with a researcher to produce a report called The Cost of Sexual Violence in Minnesota, and the results of that are really, really significant.
We know that we spend $8 billion a year on sexual violence. We know that the girls between the age of 13 and 17 are at the highest risk of victimization. We know there are certain populations that are way more victimized than others. Indian women, people of color, people with disabilities are 4 to 10 times more likely to be victims of sexual assault. There were 61,000 victims, that's the size of Owatonna and Mankato combined. This is not a small problem. It's a best guess using a lot of data, but what we do know is sexual violence is very much underreported.
So we know that we're talking about a really conservative estimate. It wasn't able to gather data from people who are non-native English speakers or women who are institutionalized or youth who are not in school any longer if they're on the streets. And very simply in hard, cold facts and figures, we can't continue to let this happen. But we have spent very little money, almost no money. In fact, in Minnesota, no state dollars on prevention of sexual violence. Prevention has always been a hard sell at the state capitol because if we prevent sexual violence, it's hard to prove it because we're proving a negative. My background in nursing always leads me in the direction of work that we can do to prevent damage, prevent harm, prevent disease, to avoid or prevent sexual violence. Schools, healthcare providers, community faith-based organizations also have a role to play in this. I think that we need to continue to pursue comprehensive sex ed in Minnesota schools. Some people object to that. that if we want our children to be prepared and we want them to be armed with the tools to avoid and prevent violence, they need to have good information. And I can do that as a parent. I'm aided if there's good information, good, accurate information coming from the schools. But then I can help my children understand.
Isn't it interesting that we're unwilling to do sex ed for kids, but they're surrounded by sex ed every day? That's two clicks of the mouse, and they're in it. And the sex ed they're getting is something none of us want them to have.
What we're doing in Ramsey County, and we've taken this to the Ramsey County Board to get this as a high priority for the board, and we've got unanimous support about this. First, we're taking a look in-house at our workplace rules and our workplace policies to ensure that we have a respectful workplace and that these are consistent with this policy about the prevention of sexual violence.
Now, they've done a study. They've quantified the cost of sexual violence in Minnesota, and they've laid out a plan. That's laid out interventions for the state to pursue. And I think that kind of foundation is really important in terms of policy making and moving an issue forward, because then we have a foundation on which to build.
But also a part of that is to be, to recognize that there is a state plan, that there is a national plan, for us to be supportive of that. There are advocacy groups that have been working on this for years and years and years and really understand that, to be supportive of the issues that they feel are critical for us to move forward.
We can't be afraid to talk about it, and we see more allies stepping up saying, no, I'm willing to step out. I see it passing my family and my community, and I'm not afraid to address it.
I think the whole objective of our work is to get men to take a stand on this. And it can be little, it can be writing a letter to your senator, it can be big, it can be working with a group in your community. We really need men involved, and we need them to do it in a way in which they take leadership from the women who have long done this work.
Well, be personally responsible. I think that's a good place for any of us to start. The other is looking at ways outside their home and in the community, just speaking out and saying when they see something that they don't care for or that they don't like.
My wife and I this morning had a great conversation about, I've heard from so many priests that they're now afraid to hug young people because of what they've been accused of. I don't want that to happen. I want priests to be able to hug my kids, because that's a part of that, about part of that realm. So how do we go about teaching not only my children, but them, what is healthy touch? So they can see positive boundaries, and then they'll be able to identify unhealthy boundaries.
Well, the prevention of sexual violence in relationship to seatbelts or smoking is different, but it's a social change.
In Minnesota, we have smoke-free environments. 10 years ago, nobody believed that would have happened, but we did it. We made some steps, and we made it happen.
And I think one of the smartest things that happened was the effort to counter market to young people.
Some of these posters we've been criticized for that, they're too risky. But sexual violence is something that people are afraid to talk about. So you kind of want to be in a place where, like, you can make it comfortable enough to talk about, but still make that impact.
I'm going to make something good out of bad, something bad. Part of my journey is to help other people.
I'm a survivor of rape as well, and that was before prostitution started. Being a survivor of prostitution, we don't think that once we get out that we'd ever be in a position like I'm in. And it brings hope for them. I mean, I go to Plymouth Workhouse and talk to the girls up there, and they are so proud of me and happy for me. So that we can do something regardless what our background is, regardless where we come from, what's happened to us.
I did survive what I did, and that gives me a lot of hope. I'm really proud to say I'm at the Coalition here. We do really great work. We have people really doing some thinking into the future that's amazing. Now there's a whole shelf. We finally have what I have been longing for, which is a literature of rape. It's a subject worth our attention. The timing of the book felt right for me to be able to do what I then started to do, which was
talk about a subject that people are not used to talking about. Imagine what the world would be like without sexual violence, where we didn't need to be fearful and we didn't need to worry so much about our kids riding their bike around the block, that we have a caring community that does not tolerate sexual violence. We don't do it here, not in Minnesota.
Well, thank you. We have just two more slides very quickly. Representative Murphy has given us some of the details from the bill that she addressed earlier, or the proposal that she addressed earlier, and that's laid out for you. And then there are other policy initiatives that we are wanting to support that would ultimately help in our move to prevent sexual violence. I thank you for the opportunity to share this information and to provide you with the information that I have just now, and would be very happy to answer questions. We also have friends from the Minnesota Department of Health in the audience who are able to answer specific questions about the cost report, should that be the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. Thank you so much for doing this and for bringing this information. First of all, in my experience, and I've been involved in some sexual violence prevention education actually in the mid-1970s as a college student, actually worked with local police officials, went around to dormitories, educated college students on preventive behaviors and for things to look for, those kinds of things. And one of my questions is that when you talk in your in the information about, you know, the state or government amount of money is zero on the prevention side. In my experience in looking over a period of years, I mean, prevention is occurring, prevention education is occurring throughout our society in many, many different venues. One is also as a former college professor, I mean, our colleges and universities do sexual violence prevention education in a variety of forms. Doctors' offices do, or at least they look for signs of, you know, possible indicators of something going. Psychologists, possibly there's curriculum based in our school, you know, health and sex education programs, etc. So it would, and then much of this is done at local state levels, you know, county levels, school district levels, private and public college levels, and I would find it important information for me to have as a state decision maker before funding new initiatives, that we had an inventory, to some extent, of, you know, where all this prevention was currently being, you know, education being done, who was doing it, at what levels, and where that is currently failing us in terms of why we would need new funds and where those would be most useful to support either existing efforts or complement and add to existing efforts. And I just was flipping through a lot of materials quickly to see, you know, what I was missing in that regard, and I didn't, you know, I didn't get to the right bit yet, but I would want to know about that before we move forward.
Ms. Dunn.
Yes, Chair Thiessen and member, one of the things that we envisioned with the demonstration project is that those teams would in fact be doing inventories at the local level, but they would be identifying who is already engaged in some kind of effort that we would understand to be primary prevention, and how could they maximize efforts across several. I mean, we envision teams that would be multidisciplinary in nature, and that would study their community and find out where is their fertile ground, where is their work that's happening. We know that Minnesota Men's Action Network has been doing work around the state through private foundation funding. We know Girl Scouts and other groups that are working with youth have an interest in this. Our interest is in maximizing those efforts and developing community-wide consistent messages about healthy sexuality, healthy relationships, and nonviolence. And so we would intend to work with those existing, identifying those existing networks that are strong in communities where they are strong, and then building on that those efforts with these community teams.
Other questions? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent a district that straddles Lake Street in South Minneapolis, which has been notorious over the years for prostitution. And in the vignette that you had there, we talked about, I think the young lady is there, I don't mean to point her, talked about prostitution being sexual violence. So I think that we need to do more, we have to do more to not only train our young folks, but to bring to light this issue of sexual violence for those that may be the pimps, if you will, excuse my French, and those that are seeking prostitutes. And not only has that had a great impact on the community that I live in, what happens to the people that are involved in that, what happens to the byproducts that they leave. So it is a huge issue in my district, and just wanted to make sure that sometimes we look at these things as, you know, these are just two people that are kind of making a decision, but it has a great, great impact on the community by and large, and it's had a great impact on the neighborhoods that I represent. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just wanted to thank Representative Murphy and you folks for being here today. I think the issue that you bring forward is obviously important and is nonpartisan. And oftentimes people like to make women's issues partisan issues, and they're most certainly not, and I think the bill you bring here today shows that.
Chair?
I just wanted to follow up with that. You know, when we had a meeting earlier, and a number of members from both the House and the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, almost cats and dogs living together, came to that meeting, and I think there was a lot of commitment in that room that this is an issue that we should work together on in a bipartisan fashion. While there are parts of some of the proposals, such as comprehensive sex ed, that not everybody's going to resonate around, there are parts of the Department of Health report working toward prevention that we can agree on, and I've committed to that to work with Representative Broad, Representative Norton, Representative Peace, and others at the table that have already expressed an interest in this.
Thank you. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Much of what we're on the prevention side, as we just alluded to earlier, there are lots of groups doing some prevention education. Much of that is focused at having women and girls, particularly, but people avoid being exposed to possible predators or know how to get out of situations if they are. How are we doing in terms of information and expertise development in the last several many years that you've been involved with this in terms of focusing this prevention at the emerging predators in terms of preventing that from happening as opposed to our trying to avoid the predators? Are we making progress on that? And is that part of the new area we need further work on?
Representative, that is clearly an area that we are starting to focus on. And part of what we are more and more aware of is that in order to truly do prevention, we have to start addressing the social norms that support behavior that is sexually violent, where violence that uses sex has become a norm, has become a normative experience for us. And so, and that approach is really all about addressing what is it in our culture in fact grows sex offenders. Why are we so good at producing sex offenders at a community level? Our focus has got to be on what are the forces at the community level that contribute to that. One of the things that the Cost of Sexual Violence Report allows us to do is look at some of the data that's collected and then start studying how does that relate to community norms and community pressures. The fact that we have, that most of the victims of sexual violence are in fact female. That's important information. That's important epidemiological information for us to look at. What is it in our society that contributes to that being the reality? I think we're not there yet, but I think that this is part of the work that we are doing, is stepping in the direction of saying how do we structure policy and organizational practice and procedure to support healthy experiences and healthy respect for individuals, male or female.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Chair, and this is done. I'm just curious, I'm sure when I get to taking the time to read through this report, it might stay in here, but when it comes to sexual violence, do you have numbers as far as the breakdown of sexual violence that is more, I guess, violent or a stranger attack somebody type violence versus coercion and whether it's date rape or it's a friend, some of the testimonies that we heard about where people don't even recognize it's sexual abuse, where obviously there are prevention measures that will be effective. You teach people and young women, young men, how to recognize the signs, recognize what is inappropriate, versus how you handle prevention for stuff that's violent attacks, you know, how the prevention plays into that and what the numbers are for something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have, there are a number of reports that have and studies that have been done over the years that primarily point out that most sexual violence that is perpetrated on victims is, in fact, a non-stranger sexual violence. And we can get you more data, but I think that in most of the studies indicate that anywhere from 85 to 95% and above would be incidents that are perpetrated by somebody who's known to the victim. So we're talking primarily about non-stranger assaults. And typically those are more likely to include coercion and pressure or in some way making the victim vulnerable and unable to protect herself.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to thank you, Representative Murphy and Ms. Dunn, for being here and shining a light on this really important issue. We are up against a pretty loud and persistent message as far as the media is concerned, and it's challenging for us. So it's important for policymakers that we look at programs such as this. And by the way, Representative Murphy did a great job on the video. very, very nice. But also I would challenge all of us to do our part in changing the social norms. I know I am the mother of two teenage boys. I care in my work for teenage women primarily. And so I don't know if I'm hypersensitive to what I see because I've read the book Reviving Ophelia. But, you know, I have been at Barnes & Noble and called them on some of their displays that are at eye level. And, you know, I find particularly offensive. And I tell them that and I let them know I'm not going to go to their, you know, the third store unless they change some of their displays. So I would just challenge all of us to really look at the world with different eyes. Start noticing some of the ads that are in magazines that are really quite offensive. I know years ago my husband bought a record album, and it was Axelrod, who is, I can't remember the group that he is, Axl Rose, Guns N' Roses, and, you know, great musicians maybe. Very offensive cover. He really didn't even think twice about it when he bought it, and I thought, I was mortified, and I made him throw it away. So, but I would just challenge all of us to do our part in changing the social mores. Thank you again.
President Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a quick comment that I really appreciate your use of the term violence that uses sex, because it really sets us a thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
President Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple questions related to statistics, but I think Representative Rood, you're absolutely right. I think this issue actually has been brought to even greater interest this last election season. When we think about what the norms are and what people say and what they write, and whether that's okay, I would argue that it's not okay to write or joke or talk about sexual violence in the manner that we have seen within the last election season. But one of the things, the question specifically that I wanted to ask is, how does Minnesota compare? How do we compare to the states around us, and how does the U.S. compare in regards to sexual violence? Because I think you make a very good point related to the culture.
Mr. Chair and Representative, several years ago, a group did a study called Rape in America, in which they studied for the basic sources of data, brought that data together, and were able to draw conclusions, some general conclusions about reporting of rape, non-reporting of rape, what the barriers are for victims, survivors, and so forth. And they were able to call from that reports that are specific to each state. And most states really share very similar statistics in terms of the rate of sexual violence or violence that uses sex. And so Minnesota, I really think, is not outside of the realm of what's fairly normal in terms of that. But we could also provide you with some very specific information about from the Rape in America study, as well as the Minnesota excerpts from that study, if you would like. Okay.
And are there, I mean, kind of building on that question, are there programs in other states that have been effective that we could model some of this, that we can model some of this on?
Well, Mr. Chair, the CDC funds the Minnesota Department of Health, and they in turn provide some funding to us, the Minnesota Department of Health, and we work very closely in collaboration with them. And we attend many trainings with the CDC to help us all understand how we can start being effective in addressing the primary prevention of sexual violence, how we can start looking at policy change. And some of the, as you look at the spectrum of prevention, some of the higher order activities and strategies that will have longer term results. One of the things the CDC has been able to tell us is they have no normed studies and no normed activities that they can share with us that say, take this and do this and you will be successful. This is an entirely new field across the nation. So every state is struggling, as are we, with how we can be successful with sexual violence. I will tell you that typically Minnesota is called forth as being one of the leaders. And so we are happy about that, and maybe we are best at posing the questions at this point and knowing what direction we need to start moving in. But we are always sad to hear from the CDC. They can't give us anything that is a strategy for moving forward at this point because there aren't studies that will lead us that direction.
Okay. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, there's a second part of Representative Broad's question having to do with comparisons of the United States to other possibly industrialized countries or other countries. And a third question is, what do we know about trends in the U.S. or Minnesota? Well, the data may have not been very good, I'm sure, much of the time, but so do we know anything about trends based on any decent data?
Mr. Chair. I think that is information that we can also find for you. We know that one trend that we do see is that we see an increasingly sexualized public media that is providing increasingly sexualized and degrading images of children, oftentimes sexualized images of children, of men, and of women. And so we know that there is a trend around how we are presented as images in the media, and we know that contributes to how individual children, women, and men are perceived by those who are in a position to have to take advantage of them. And so we know, I mean, the trends for the trending for the representation of individuals in the media is something that we are very concerned about. How that relates to actual violence is something that we continue to study and that we continue to look at. Cordelia Anderson is a national expert on this issue, and I know that we can find some information from her and share it with you. We'd be happy to do that.
Is there someone from the department that can come down and talk about maybe what recommendations they might have for on this front? Ms. Manning, I guess, yes, would be that person, perhaps. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mary Manning, Director of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease with the State Health Department. As far as recommendations, right now what we would be doing is looking towards the preliminary research and activity that the CDC is doing and working with stakeholders along with MnCASA to see what are promising practices. And believe the planning policy direction that's mentioned in the report is the way to start looking and examining what could be done. We don't have anything specific to recommend at this time.
Okay, thank you. I understand in the original draft of this cost of sexual violence report, there actually were some specific recommendations made, including comprehensive sexual education. And I'm just wondering what happened with those recommendations.
Chair, committee, my knowledge of the cost report is strictly that we were looking at what were costs, and that was a decision to be made. I don't actually recall any policy recommendations in the report. I know that we were instructed to have a cost report, but I'm not sure if for this report there were certain recommendations that were formulated.
Were you around at the time that the report was issued?
Yes, I was.
Okay. I just have a copy of the report as it was originally published, and then I guess it was withdrawn at some point, and it has a paragraph that's missing from the actual end report that talks about comprehensive sex education, community-based sexual violence prevention teams. But if you don't know about that, it would be helpful to get some information from maybe someone else at the Department of Health about the decision-making that went into withdrawing that paragraph from the what was finally published.
We can get back to you with that.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you. Representative Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, this looks like a good program. As you know, this is not budget committee, but there's some numbers attached to it, and we're running pretty short on money. Or let's say if we don't have the money for it, is this program going to continue, or are there stuff out there that you might be able to do some work without this money?
Mr.
Chair and Representative Tao, it is it's frustrating to me that we have, I think, an identified path to move forward. And we know that a little bit of financial input would provide for the state, in the long run, a budget reduction, as well as a reduction in human suffering. I wish we could move on the bill now. But if we're not able, I think that the work of MnCASA and the Department of Health will continue. And the work within the legislature, among those of us and the growing number of members that are interested in this, will continue so that we're ready to go when our budget situation is improved. I really was serious in the beginning of the meeting when we had, when I participated in the meeting with Cordelia Anderson. I learned a lot at that meeting. She really broadened my perspective. I think there are a number of topics embedded in this issue that are going to challenge us as policymakers. Language, societal things, images, things that will make us uncomfortable in terms of what's our role as policymakers, how do we affect that, and what's the role of families, schools, communities. I think that, by its nature, makes this a public health issue because we have to look at the different spheres of influence. So I'm very realistic about our ability to move forward with the bill. I get that part. But I think we need to continue, and part of that will be us getting more familiar with the topical areas, getting more comfortable with the language, so that when we can move, we will.
Yeah, no
problem. Thank you. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, I 100% agree. I was just thinking about a bill that we passed a few years ago related to violent video games. And the word violent was about guns, and it was about blood, and it was about all those things that it had. I don't think that bill reached into the realm of sexual violence or how women are portrayed or perceived. And so, I think there are some policy things that we certainly should be and can be doing. I think about Representative, who has it? The bill's related to MySpace, and the bill's related to Twitter and all those online areas that are now pretty scary as a parent of a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old. I think those are policy things that we certainly can work together on outside of the realm of the budget. And I think that some of these things will rise to the top in terms of priorities. And so I just wanted to throw those two ideas out there as things that we could potentially be looking at.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Where is this coming from?
Mr. Chair, what you have is an executive summary of the Minnesota Department of Health 5-year strategic plan. Each state was directed by the CDC to go through the process of developing a 5-year strategic plan for preventing sexual violence. This is the executive summary of the Health Department's plan. I'm not sure the entire plan has been issued yet, but there are action teams that have begun working around the strategies that were identified in this plan.
Okay, so this is a current
yes.
coming out right now
yes.
kind of thing. Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. We didn't pull it up. So that is the end. Thank you very much. This is really helpful and informative.
Thank you for your time.
And, yeah, let us know what you want to do, Representative Murphy.
I love
you. Okay. All right. Because this the funding is in a different, but it's not in Tom's budget, right? It's in Representative Paymore's budget?
Mr. Chair and members, are you, Mr. Chair, are you asking about funding currently or where we would go?
The demonstration grant.
I believe it is in Representative Paymore's.
Okay. All right.
Although, yep.
Thank you. All right. We can someone move to approve the minutes? We can move on with that from the all right, Representative Fritz, from the February 5th meeting. Any discussion on that? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you. Representative Rood. Representative Rood moves that House File number 550 be recommended, passed, and referred to the K-12 Education Policy Committee. And members, the Education Policy Committee is going to deal with Section 1 of the bill. So we're going to focus on Sections 2 and 3 of the bill, which are on sexually transmitted infections. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to sit here because we'll do it for testifiers. They'll be coming and they will be using a PowerPoint. I'm not sure where they are, but I'm optimistic that they're nearby. Do I need to move the bill? I'm sorry. Do I need to move that?
Yeah, I moved it on your behalf.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I want to thank you for taking the time to hear this bill. I also want to acknowledge that I am aware of our current budget situation, but I think this is important information for us as policymakers to hear. We are members of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. This is very important information. And it's important for us to recognize and learn about the public health trends. It's important, though, that we don't just hear those trends in isolation and hear about the statistics in isolation, but because I think when we hear the data in isolation, it prevents us from orienting ourselves as to where we are with our current policies, where we need to go, and how we need to get there. The topic you are going to hear about is very near and dear to my heart. I have a passion for working with people who are underserved. In my early years as a nurse practitioner, I worked in San Francisco. I actually worked at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, which is kind of ground zero. And it was at that time where what was going on with the virus that causes HIV was being identified. It had yet to be identified. So it was very interesting times. I have worked in clinics in San Francisco, in Milwaukee, in Madison, in Minneapolis. And I have treated a lot of patients who have STIs. This past year, I would say, it was stunning to me to kind of realize I don't think I've ever treated as many as I have this past year. The trends are really quite striking, and you are going to hear about those. It is always difficult to tell somebody that they are HIV positive or that they have syphilis or gonorrhea or chlamydia. It's even more difficult if they're young or if they're pregnant. On the flip side of that, it's very difficult to tell a young woman who is trying to get pregnant that she can't because it appears her tubes are blocked because of an infection that she acquired as a teenager with chlamydia. So with that, I'm going to just briefly walk through the bill because I do have testifiers, and I'm hoping you hear a pace, right? Are they all set? Oh, thank you. I didn't see you there. I apologize. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, thank you. I think you mentioned that we are not going to address the Section 1 of the bill, the education piece, but I do want to... Representative Murphy's bill that we just heard that touched on the importance of education, and I do believe that education is a very key part of this issue as well. Section 2 of the bill requires the Commission of Health to conduct an assessment and develop recommendations for reducing STIs. And as I mentioned, you are going to be hearing testimony regarding the current STI trends. This is a public health issue. I do think it is important that we have a plan of action so that we know where we want to go and how we want to get there. It's important that we take steps to reverse the disturbing trend that we are going to be hearing about. Section 3 appropriates funding for family planning special project grants
and appropriates money to provide additional detection and treatment of chlamydia and gonorrhea. When you're going to hear from some of the clinics today that are the providers for some of these services, and I think it's really important for you to hear that many of the patients that are seen in these clinics, this is maybe their first and perhaps their only interaction with the healthcare system. And that's really important to think about because they are providing a very special and important service. So with that, I am going to turn it over to my testifiers. And I believe the first testifier is Mr. David Johnson. He is an epidemiologist at the Minneapolis Department of Health and Family Support. And would you like to sit over here, Mr. Johnson, or is that a good spot? Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the introduction, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Johnson. I am an epidemiologist with the Minneapolis Department of Health and Family Support, and I have a two-part testimony here to give to you today. First, I'm going to be giving a presentation that was prepared by Peter Carr, who is the STD and HIV Section Director at the Minnesota Department of Health. He couldn't be with us today and asked that I take that part of the testimony for him. Then I will also be giving some testimony reflecting our experiences in the city of Minneapolis. With that, first I'm just going to run through some of the recent data and what we know about these diseases in Minnesota. Yes, and you should have this all in your packet. Thank you. In 2007, there were a total of 17,057 STD cases reported to the Minnesota Department of Health. I should mention also that 13,412 of those were chlamydia, about 3,500 gonorrhea, 186 of those were syphilis cases. I'd like to point out that chlamydia is the most commonly reported disease to the Minnesota Department of Health of all the diseases out there. This includes the first flu and all the rest of the diseases that are reportable. So chlamydia is the top. I'd also like to point out, when we're talking about these statistics, that up to one half of chlamydia and gonorrhea cases can be asymptomatic. So that means that people, someone who has the infection, the carrier of the infection, can be walking around and leading a very normal life, completely unaware of the fact that they are infected and spreading these diseases to others. And so that's very important to remember when we're talking about these statistics, because these are only the cases of disease that we know about. These are people who are coming into clinics, being screened, tested, and treated. And so that said, there's likely a lot of disease out there that we are not reflecting in these numbers. And I'll come back to that. Another thing I'd like to bring your attention to is over the past 10 years, we've had a dramatic increase statewide in the number and rate of chlamydia in Minnesota. And so we've had a near doubling in the past 10 years of the rate of chlamydia across the state. And again, this is simply showing a low in 1996, looking over the decade of the 90s into this century, to a high of 273 cases per 100,000 residents in the state. When we talk about the populations that are most impacted by these diseases, we're really talking about young adults, people who are otherwise healthy, leading productive lives, thinking about their futures, yet they're the ones who are at highest risk for these infections. When we look at the disease broken down by gender, we see that females are a lot more likely to have disease reported on them. This is largely an artifact of screening. Women are more likely to go to get medical care in clinics, annual physicals, men such as myself often just don't go to the doctor as much. So we don't get screened as much. Therefore, the rates that are reported among males are much lower. But that's not to say that we're looking enough in that population. The actual rate is much higher than what we see here in the reported cases, due to the fact that many males can be walking around asymptomatic, not knowing that they have the disease. Again, we see a similar trend related to gonorrhea. The age tends to be a little older for gonorrhea as opposed to chlamydia, but again, largely affecting young adults, and with the reporting bias there towards females. Another thing I'd like to draw your attention to is the disproportionate impact of these diseases have on low-income communities and populations of color. Here you can see rates among Black African Americans are much higher than those in the other racial and ethnic communities. And again, here's the gonorrhea rates, again demonstrating the large disparity by race and ethnicity. And at this point, I'd just like to also point out that this is also an artifact of the case that it's not only an individual's risk behaviors that put them at risk for an FCD, it's also the community and environment in which they live. And so a person who has similar risk behavior profile living in an area or a community with high rates of disease is at much higher risk, despite the fact that they have the same risk profile as someone who lives in a different community. Looking across the state, chlamydia cases are largely focused in the Twin Cities and the urban core. There are a couple areas of the state that also show up red here. Blue Earth County is Mankato State. They do a lot of screening there. And again, this is also an artifact of screening due to this effect of having more cases being reported where the screening is better. And the same is the case with Beltrami County. There are a couple clinics up there who are doing a very good job with screening on chlamydia. Again, here, this shows the chlamydia by residents in just a different graph. Gonorrhea, again, largely an urban issue. And with that, I'd like to conclude that portion, the data portion of my presentation, and I just pause here. I do have another portion of my testimony, but I'd like to give people a chance to digest that, and I'll pause for questions at this time.
Yeah, thank you. Questions? Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. In regards to the data, is there actually a major increase, or are we just doing a better job of screening?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. That's a good point. That we do have evidence that clinics are doing a better job. There's actually data at Minnesota Community Measurement. You can go online and see how your clinic is doing with regard to a wide range of issues. Chlamydia is one of those issues that is measured. Chlamydia, there's also a performance measure that health plans look at where women between the ages of 15 and 24, I believe, are recommended to be screened. And so this has helped bring screening along better. So I think some of it is indeed an artifact of a better job screening. But due to the nature of the data, asymptomatic cases, we can't, there's also a sort of a gray area where we can't know exactly what's happening with the actual rates, because we've never actually known what the actual rates have been. So it is also the case that doesn't exclude the possibility that there is an actual increase in the rates of disease in our community.
And do they screen under those proposals for all of the STIs or just chlamydia?
Mr. Chair, the recommendation is limited to chlamydia, but in practice, I would say that gonorrhea is definitely included in there.
And I just asked that because the gonorrhea rates aren't going up according to this, so the screening may not explain the whole thing, right? Or am I kind of interpreting that wrong?
Mr. Chair, I would say that that's probably something that we should take into account. Like I say, the data is a little fuzzy just because we don't know the actual rates, but that's something that we would look to in helping us decide whether or not this was a real increase, and that would point to the fact that it is a real increase in chlamydia.
Okay. But Representative Ruud.
Mr. Chair, if I can add, oftentimes in the clinic, you will do one test that actually tests for both chlamydia and gonorrhea. So, you know, clearly we are doing a better job at screening. The CDC has recommended that. Some of us have always done it, probably because of where we trained. It has been hard to get people to start change their behavior and starting to screen on a more regular basis. But I'm really curious as to what the 08 data will show, because I do think that we are seeing an increase, and I think that's also reflected in the data.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson. I also was looking at the third slide in your presentation and wondering about that, the changing profile of chlamydia versus the other STDs that are on here. You know, and I guess, to me, I guess it would sort of explain it that, you know, better detection would kind of explain that gap, right? Because it's basically the same risk behavior that you would... that would be there, that you would be at risk, you know, if you're at risk for chlamydia, you're probably at risk for gonorrhea as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that difference, unless you have another way to explain that, do you?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't have another explanation for that. So I think that's a reasonable conclusion.
And Mr. Chair, and one other question I had about one of your graphs here is... turning to the graphs that show the difference by race and ethnicity, that's just striking. And I just wonder, I know you talked about, you know, the community that you're in and so on, but it just doesn't make sense to me. You know, I just kind of don't have an image of why there should be such a difference with our black population as opposed to these other populations. Do you have any sense of why that is the case? I mean, that's pretty troubling.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there's a lot of issues that are in play here when we look at racial disparities in health topics, and those complex interactions are no less complex when we look at sexually transmitted diseases, the interplay of poverty, historical racism, discrimination, differences in behavior. There's a lot going on there, and I don't have the one answer probably to give you here today, but it's something that we're working on. Those of us who are working in this area are working on that,
yeah.
And aware of it.
If I could, Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up to that. I mean, just, you know, usually I'm used to seeing things grouped a little differently than this. I mean, you know, you've got the American Indian population, the Hispanic population, you know, everybody's low except for the black population. So, yeah, it would be very good to dig into why that is the case.
Okay. Do you want to go on with the other part of your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just advance this to the end here. Thank you again. The second piece of my testimony here today is to address the pieces of this legislation before us that address the increasing STD screening. As a city in Minneapolis with a rate of chlamydia that's three times higher than the rest of the state, we are keenly aware of the increasing trend in chlamydia across Minnesota. But I think we also have some key answers about what to do in addressing this issue in our communities. Today, I'd like to offer testimony in order to advocate for the greater attention to the disproportionate adverse impact of chlamydia on populations of color and low-income residents, for proven public health approaches for chlamydia reduction, screening, and treatment, and for using creative strategies that draw on the wisdom of our communities to implement these programs, and for the active participation of young people in the delivery of our public health messages. Recent research on STD transmission shows us that a person's risk for infection is not solely the result of personal behaviors, but is also a function of the amount of disease in their community network, as I mentioned earlier. In Minneapolis, some of our communities have reached a tipping point where the rate of disease is so high that it is virtually self-sustaining, which blunts the effects of programs designed solely around behavior change. In these communities, we need targeted screening programs to identify and treat the disease. I'd like to tell you about a project that our health department started working on about 5 years ago. We were fortunate to meet with a young man who had been working in his community, educating his peers about HIV and STD prevention. He found it troubling that even when he talked to a young person who was at high risk for an STD and counseled them that they needed to go to a clinic and get a test, that the majority of those he talked to would not. They may have been uninsured, lacked money or transportation, distrusted the medical system, feared unknown medical procedures, or worried that their parents would be notified of their clinic visit. Partnering with two local clinics, we received a grant to hire peer educators to not only promote healthy behavior, but to expand access to screening by bringing specimen kits to the streets for those who weren't showing up at the clinics. We specifically focused on young males because they are much less likely to get clinical services compared to females, but were at risk for an STD infection. Furthermore, by focusing on males, we were seeking to reduce the risk of reinfection to females who were already being screened through routine clinic procedures. We hired and trained young people from the community who could talk to their peers frankly about STD risk and condom use. Our outreach workers named the project Seen on the Streets because they would do their work in Minneapolis parks, barber shops, convenience store parking lots, buses and light rail trains, job training centers, churches, and on the street, places where young men congregated. Our outreach workers are able to communicate about sexual risks in a way that health professionals simply can't. They represent the community they serve. They have many of the same struggles and issues that face their clients, and they are inherently culturally competent. They are able to gain the trust of their audience and to speak to them in a way that their peers can immediately relate to. We've talked to more than 11,000 young people in the 5 years of the project, and we've conducted more than 1,000 tests for chlamydia and gonorrhea in non-clinical settings, bringing this service to people who would otherwise have not sought care. Over the past 5 years, while chlamydia rates have risen 33% in other areas of Minnesota, they have risen only 2% in Minneapolis. This is the type of creative, community-driven program that can be effective in combating disease. I'd also like to point out, in my experience working with these youth, conversations about sex and sexually transmitted disease are no longer a taboo topic confined to locker room talk and hushed whispers. The media environment that our young people are growing up with is increasingly saturated with messages about sex. The youth I work with are anxious to reclaim this issue from the marketers and advertisers and promote the development of sexuality in their own terms, in a way that supports their individual choices and health. For example, the Health Committee of our Minneapolis Youth Congress, which advises our mayor and city council, this fall selected STD prevention as a top priority for their advocacy. The Minneapolis Girls in Action program, which connects female high school students with mentoring support, independently sought out education on STD prevention, and then these young women went back to their schools to educate their peers. They even participated in the production of a television show on the dangers of STDs, which was aired on Twin Cities Public Television. As public health professionals and policymakers, we need to continue to engage with these youth to harness their energy and skills and to allow them to tell us what works best in reaching their peers. By combining proven public health strategies with community wisdom and youth involvement, we can continue to effectively provide education, screening, and treatment on chlamydia. These programs require resources, but their cost is modest compared with the cost of complications of untreated chlamydia, such as pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility, and ectopic pregnancy. Programs such as these are sadly rare and currently exist largely outside the scope of the healthcare system, relying on other mechanisms for their support. The federal funding for our Feet on the Streets program recently ended without renewal. We have been able to continue funding the program using state public health funds, but with reduced capacity. It is our hope that we can continue to support and expand population screening efforts such as these to reduce the burden of chlamydia on our communities. Thank you.
Any questions, members? Okay, thank you very much.
The next testifier is Kathy Witt. She is a public health nurse and the public health supervisor at the Dakota County Public Health Department.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
members, you have 6 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. And I appreciate being here and having this opportunity. My name is Kathy Wick, and I am a public health supervisor with Dakota County Public Health, supervising our disease prevention and control program. And I'm here today to dispel any myths that may linger that living in the suburbs confers protection from acquiring sexually transmitted diseases. Just to give you a little bit of background on Dakota County, which pretty much rings the whole southern portion of the metro area, we're the third largest county population-wise in the state at 391,000 and have a significant urban, suburban, and well as rural areas. 12.6% of our population is age 15 to 24, which is a population that reports the greatest number of chlamydia cases. And the majority of health care in Dakota County is delivered by private providers. There are a lot of free clinics, school-based health care, none of that. It's primary care, OBGYN, pediatricians. And our poverty and our uninsurance rates are generally unremarkable. They're consistent with other suburban counties, although that may change given the economic times. And my point in telling you these statistics is that it is not for lack of health resources or high poverty rates that we have a problem in Dakota County. It's really about an uninformed community, about a target population that is not aware of the risks and the consequences of acquiring an STI and doesn't know when to seek care. It's also a bit about lack of easy access to that care as well. We know from the data we get that a good percentage of our youth and young adults are going to our neighboring counties of Hennepin and Ramsey. And accessing care there through some of the low-cost STD clinics that are there. This slide just points out that in 2006, over a third of the cases that were reported to the state were from the suburban areas of the metropolitan area. And I like this slide. It says spiraling rates of infection. Looks like I got cut off a bit, but this was a year later, and that was a headline that ran in the Star Tribune. It's an iceberg, and it talks about, really, it depicts how chlamydia and the cases that we are seeing is only the tip of the iceberg, and that largely most cases, they go undetected because there are no symptoms. And so when I go on here to talk about the experience in Dakota County, that is, again, only about the cases that we know about that were reported. So what's the scope of the problem in Dakota County? Well, we've seen a 123% increase from 2001 in our chlamydia rates, a 59% increase in gonorrhea. This is incidence, cases per 100,000. So in 2007, that was 794 cases of chlamydia and 124 cases of gonorrhea. When we look at our rates compared to the state, they're a little lower. But pretty much mirroring the state trend. And if we go back to 2000, we've seen 142% increase in our chlamydia rates. This is an epidemiological model for Dakota County, and it's like a best-case, worst-case scenario. And if you look at the best-case scenario, and we do the linear population growth, and we increase our screening, and we increase our treatment, and not every case goes on to confer another case, we will see increases in our rates, but at half as much as if we do nothing, which, worst-case scenario, you're seeing an exponential growth rate where screening and treatment stays the same, and each case goes on to infect another, and then we're looking at rates that are approaching 600 cases per 100,000, which is nearly double what we're seeing right now. Chances are it'll be somewhere in between.
Okay. Do we know how that compares nationally? I mean, do we have comparative statistics?
I haven't seen that kind of modeling nationally,
okay.
But I bet the State Health Department has.
All right, thanks.
So why do we care? This is a disease that is silent in its symptoms. And as Senator Rood had already spoken to, there are significant health consequences when left untreated. To name one consequence, pelvic inflammatory disease will occur in 40% of all women who are untreated.
of 40% of all women untreated, they will go on to develop PID, often without symptoms, and 20% of those will become infertile. And we know that all infertility right now, 15% are attributable to pelvic inflammatory disease. And just as an aside, there's data to show that it costs 20 times more to treat a case of PID than it does of screening and treatment of chlamydia. And when we have people who don't have symptoms not seeking screening, and we have a clinical model that relies on self-report, we continue to have ongoing transmission between unsuspecting partners. The other reason we care is that it disproportionately impacts our teens, our young adults, and women. And the ages of 15 to 24 comprise 14% of our state population, but account for 69% of all cases reported. This is an age group with the least amount of resources and the greatest barriers to deal with getting screened and treated. And so we care because it significantly is impacting the current health and the future well-being of our young adult population. This is also a disease that is silent in its knowledge. And in Dakota County, we see teens and young adults that are unaware that they can have infection without symptoms. And while healthcare providers are doing a better job of screening, we still need healthcare providers who are unaware of the need to routinely screen. And by their own standards, they are not measuring up to those and screening every woman annually between the ages of 15 and 24 who is sexually active. That's not talked about, not enough. There's not enough prevention education going on to teens and to young adults in schools and in places where young people congregate so that they can become knowledgeable and take action and know what it is they need to do. So we have our youth getting hurt because they simply don't know. What are we doing about it in Dakota County? In the past year, we have gone to almost every single primary care clinic in our county and met one-on-one and have done education on the nature and the prevalence of the disease to healthcare providers and talked about clinical standards of screening and treatment and have given them provider and patient educational material. Much of this done as a result of a grant from Medica that we received. And so there aren't a lot of resources that we've been able to put to it. But we have also done outreach to other healthcare providers and to school health professionals, and we're happy to see that clinics are definitely showing some improvement in the number of screenings that they are doing. But we're chipping away at this lack of awareness, kind of one clinic at a time, one school at a time. There are 10 school districts in Dakota County and about 17 public high schools. So it's a lot of effort, and we haven't yet quite made it all of the high schools. What we feel we need is the opportunities for screening and treatment to be increased in all healthcare settings, and that there's a state-led education campaign with the goal of targeting both healthcare providers and the targeted populations, that they understand the increased prevalence of STIs and the nature of them, and that they are seeking the testing and the treatment that they need and that it's getting provided, and that our youth are taking the steps that they need to take to reduce their risk. We believe in Dakota County that without a central state-led message, we really can't make a dent in this problem, and that we need to teach and screen and treat, or we need to talk about screening and treatment and doing more education in the hopes of eventually really capping the growth of what we see as an epidemic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Rudin, the testifier. What kind of curriculum are we talking about here?
I mean, we're not talking about Section 1 in this. That's on the jurisdiction of our committee. So we're going to, and we're running out of time here. That's the Education Committee. Thank you. All right. Thank you. Representative Bunn, we don't have a lot of time.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's partly a comment. It strikes me that here's this one other area where there may be or there should be an evidence-based medicine preventive care standard, whether by the National Quality Forum or by our ICSI in Minnesota, that basically establishes for all healthcare provided delivery systems state that, you know, for this for this topic, you know, ages 15 to 24, you should test this how often,
and it will be covered by all our health plans and whatever ages. And so just one other area that seems like just some, you know, statewide application of this is the evidence-based best practice for dealing with this issue in our state. You know, all health care plans, all state programs should be doing this. Would make a lot more sense than each of you counties struggling to go school by school or provider to do this. And so while I'm totally supportive of any efforts we might be having to do in this fashion now, I think there's just one more area that there's much more efficient system-wide based ways we should be getting at this in the longer term here.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can we adjourn at 4:15 or 4:30?
We're going to keep going.
Okay, because I do have some more testifiers.
Yes, and we can't go to all the way to 4:30, but...
Okay, thank you. I would next like to call forward Deb Wilkins-Costello, who is the Executive Director at Family Tree Clinic in St. Paul. Oh, we need a tag team at 10. Absolutely. I will step aside. And also Betty Nelson, who is the President of State Plant and the Executive Director Outlook Clinic, Northwest.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for being here.
And we have about 5 minutes for this piece, but thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Betty Nelson, the President of Minnesota State Plan, which is the statewide family planning association. I'm also the Executive Director of Outlook Health Services, which provides family planning services in Kennebec, Chisago, and Isani counties since 1985. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk with you about the critical need for the ongoing family planning special projects funding. I believe that there are few decisions in life that have greater effect on families than the decisions of when and whether to have children. The term family planning is often misunderstood. Family planning is more than just handing out contraceptives. It encompasses all aspects of preventative and reproductive health care, including routine gynecological exams, pap smears, breast cancer screening and treatment for sexually transmitted infections, information and methods of birth control, and pregnancy testing. Family planning helps women and families prepare financially, physically, and emotionally to bring children into the world. Many women have access to adequate medical care. However, in Minnesota, there are 253,000 women who have either no access or limited access to contraceptive care and are therefore in need of subsidized services. There are two primary funding sources of subsidized family planning services in Minnesota. One is the Minnesota-funded Family Planning Special Projects Program that we are discussing today. The other is the federally funded Minnesota Family Planning Program known as MFTP. MFTP was created to supplement FPSP, not to replace it. Minnesota's public health safety net of small family planning clinics and county health departments will not survive without the combination of both programs. There are currently 42 programs receiving FPSP funding through the Minnesota Department of Health. These programs serve 83 cities throughout the state. This map shows the locations of the FPSP clinics in Minnesota. As you can see, they are fairly well spread throughout the state. These clinics provide services to 27,000 individuals. The federally funded Minnesota Family Planning Program provides care to an additional 20,000 individuals. This then still leaves more than 200,000 women who qualify for subsidized family planning services who cannot be served due to the lack of funding. So what is the impact? We know that for every $1 spent on family planning, a minimum of just over $4 is saved in Medicaid-related birth costs. Every decrease in family planning funding results in an additional $5.40 of public expense for prenatal and delivery costs. It is likely the governor's proposed cuts to FPSP of over $1 million per year would result in additional expenses to the state of over $11 million for the biennium. Some say the state cannot afford to spend money on family planning. I say the state can't afford not to spend money on family planning. The FPSP program allows clinics to keep their doors open so they are able to serve both FPSP and MFTP clients. The FPSP program provides clinics with a crucial delivery system for the Minnesota Family Planning Program.
If the SPSP clinics go down, who will provide services to the MSPP clients? Family planning impacts individuals in a number of ways. Family planning often provides the only access to health care for women and men and provides access points to primary health care. Family planning gives individuals the education they need to be sexually responsible. Family planning encourages people to seek loving and stable relationships. Family planning counsels young people to delay early sexual activity. Family planning encourages the use of contraception until individuals are ready and willing to be responsible parents. And family planning promotes healthy mothers and babies. If there is any concern among you, be assured that the Family Planning Special Projects Program does not provide any funding for abortion or abortion-related services.
So what happens if we lose funding? I want to just take a couple of minutes to talk about that. Fewer women will be served, leading to a rise in unintended pregnancies and abortions. An immediate added Medicaid expense to the state for prenatal care and delivery costs. There will be added welfare costs, which will likely continue for years. An example of that is 54% of MFIP expenditures go to families that began with a teenager giving birth. That equates to $120 million per year. So I've taken, I run the Family Tree Clinic in St. Paul, and what if we lose funding at our clinic? We've been around for 37 years. Fewer medical staff and no interpreters will be available to serve poor and uninsured women. We serve almost 6,000 men and women teens every year that come in for low-cost, confidential, and accurate care around family planning services, primarily serving 19 to 30-year-olds. Without FPSP funding, there would be a 40% reduction in patient services at our clinic alone. Access to medically accurate and age-appropriate sexual health information to high-risk youth would stop. Family Tree Clinic educates incarcerated juveniles and those transitioning out of corrections on unplanned pregnancy and STD prevention. In addition to the outreach in corrections, we provide the same information to youth and adults in chemical dependency treatment centers, as well as those who are homeless or in transitional housing projects. Our clinic alone educated 5,000 clients through 2008 with our community outreach in those areas. The program works to reduce unwanted pregnancies, especially for teenagers, in focused high-risk populations in Minnesota. Deaf, blind, and hard of hearing programs will no longer exist. Family Tree Clinic is the only community clinic that offers in the state of Minnesota serving deaf, blind, and hard of hearing individuals focusing on pregnancy prevention and STIs. This program serves the metro area as well as outstate locations. It serves a very diverse population, including Somali, Hmong, Africans, African Americans, Russians, and Asian clients. We connect with over 1,200 deaf, blind, hard-of-hearing individuals a year. The Minnesota Hotline, Family Planning Hotline, would close. Again, Family Tree Clinic houses the only hotline for the state of Minnesota, and it would cease to exist without the FPSP funding. We receive over 3,000 calls a year from all 87 counties, and they access this hotline for both information and referrals.
And we need to finish up in about a minute, if
okay.
We could. Thanks.
Well, in closing, let me say that...
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. You know, we're good at this. Are we here? We understand the situation that the budget is in, obviously. But according to the health department, family planning has been underfunded for many, many years. We feel so strongly it's about prevention, and that it's a strategic investment for the state of Minnesota. The consequence of not funding this is more unplanned pregnancies. It's serious, it's expensive, and with that, we'll ask for questions.
Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking for clarification because I heard you state that you were concerned about cost reductions, and it was my understanding that this is all new money in this grant, and that we're not actually addressing the
perhaps any recommended cuts. Am I correct in that, or have I misunderstood?
I think the difference in the governor's proposal and this proposal is what you're asking about. Do you want to, I don't know if Maria or Representative Hood or if someone else wants to address that. It's a good question.
You want me to? Our presentation is about FPSP funding, which is right now, there is a reduction suggested by the governor, as well as meeting the needs of those individual clinic grantees that did not receive money in the past. Do you want to add, Teddy, to that?
So the question is this $3 million new, would that be an above the base money? Yes. Okay. And the $1.3 million is as well. For the chlamydia and gonorrhea testing. Okay, so
can I ask the chair a follow-up then? Typically in policy committee hearings, we vote on the policy, and finance would deal with the finance. And
Tom will be dealing with the finance.
Okay, because I'm perfectly fine with the policy. I'm a little concerned with the finance, and I don't serve on that committee, so I will assume that they will iron out any financial, how this fits in your budget in that committee.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really, what we're focusing on is kind of how can we get after this issue of the FTI increases that have been discussed, and what are the consequences of not doing that with family planning grants and other things. Okay, thank you. Mr. Pritchard? And again, we're focusing on sections 2 and 3.
So I understand that. Tom Pritchard, Minnesota Family Council. I just wanted to just make a couple quick points. One is the concerns we do have about Section 1, but also I think carry over to family planning money in terms of what is the focus. Is it just contraceptive? I know there was comments made, well, we encourage teens to wait until they're ready, but we think the focus should be on marriage. We think marriage is a fundamental institution in our society, which is absolutely vital for the well-being of society. And when you tell kids just to wait until they're ready, what is that? I mean, what teen is not going to say they're ready to have sex? And so we think the message should be clearly on marriage and on abstinence. It's interesting. Chlamydia is a, as you saw or we saw, is a growing problem, and it's spread through non-intercourse sexual activity. So condoms don't prevent that, and it also doesn't prevent the emotional harm and damage done from premarital sexual activity. So we just want to emphasize that and say that that is going to get us to the source of the problem rather than just focusing on contraceptives, which I think has been the traditional focus. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you for coming down. I don't know. Does anybody have any questions? Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. My question, just briefly, and we don't have much time, you know, the studies that have come out about focusing on abstinence-based education, they don't seem to be particularly effective, but we're not focusing on that part of the bill today, so I guess we can just leave it with that as well.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, let me just say, though, that I would question, I mean, I think they're applicable to this bill if you're increasing funding for family planning, and, you know, I think we have a crisis of STDs because I think the approach has been wrong. We're talking about contraceptives, and I would question what specific studies are we talking about and what is the actual reason. I think there's a lot of misrepresentation in the media about whether abstinence is a failed approach, when in fact it's 100% successful when it's approached and applied.
Okay, I appreciate that. All right, any other questions? Okay, I think it's time to vote on the bill. Representative Wood, any closing comments?
No, thank you,
okay.
Members.
All right, Representative Wood will renew her motion that House File 550 be approved and re-referred to the K-12 Education Policy Committee. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No. Nope.
Motion prevails. Thank you, members.
Thank you,
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, members. Thank you.
Oh, and we're going to adjourn.
No.